The following episode was recorded June 9th, 2023, prior to the news of the OceanGate Titan tragedy. This episode was originally scheduled to be published on June 20th, but obviously it just did not feel right to do that, so we have held off on posting this one for a while, especially following the news of the devastating outcome on June 22nd. We did do a poll on Instagram last week about what we should do, and the vast majority of our followers over there let us know that they thought it would have been okay for us to go ahead and publish the episode last week and move forward with the podcast, which was very reassuring to know, but I personally was still feeling a little uneasy about everything, so we took an extra week away, which I'm sure you guys can understand. We have received a lot of messages and comments asking for our thoughts on the whole situation, so we may talk about that whenever we record our next episode. But today we have Scene 29 for you, featuring another special guest, Eddie Green, who's a friend of ours, and it's a really good one, I think. You know, we had a really good time discussing the scene. So even though things have been really dark and heavy over these last few weeks, we do hope that the podcast can still be a bright spot in your day, as this is a movie that we all love so dearly and means so much to so many. So, yeah, thank you, and we hope you enjoy the episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to James Cameron's Titanic Scene by Scene. I'm Brittany Butler.
I'm Ethan Brim.
And today we have another special guest with us to talk about the scene titled Swept Away, which is scene 29 for us. So today our guest is Eddie Green. Pretty funny story, I guess, kind of funny to me, about how and why he is on the show with us today. It must have been like 2019. You had written to us and said, hey, when you ever get to this scene with that giant wave coming down the hallway, I'd love to come on for that scene. And at the time, that was so long ago, it felt like it would take absolutely forever for us to make it to that scene. But here we are today, lo and behold, we have finally made it all the way to this moment. And I thought to myself, you know what? I need to write to Eddie and say, hey, we finally made it to that scene you mentioned 4 years ago that you'd want to come on for. So do you still want to come on? And here you are. So
here I am.
Hello, Eddie. How are you?
Hello. It's good to see you again, Brittany. Yes. This is my first time meeting Ethan, but I've been in contact with Brittany for quite some time, and you've been on some stuff that I've done on my YouTube channel, and I'm happy that we've come full circle now. This is quite literally, this is it right now. This is very exciting stuff.
It is. It's crazy. So yeah, so from my understanding, you're kind of more of, I'd say, like a James Cameron head than a Titanic head, kind of. I know you have a deep love of Terminator, so.
Yes, because when I reached out to you, I believe at that time I was doing a podcast, like I thought it was going to go in the direction of either Terminator or James Cameron. Actually, I think it was Terminator.
It was definitely Terminator. I still have, you sent us a voice message and I still have it.
Jeez.
Would you like to hear it?
Play it. I thought I just wrote. I gotta remember.
No, you sent us one back on June 6th, 2019. So almost literally.
Yeah. So what's today, the 9th?
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. That's crazy.
To the day almost is when you left this. So this is what you had said.
Oh boy.
Back then.
Hey, Brittany and Ethan. My name is Eddie Green. I'm the creator and host of a podcast called Terminator 101, which is dedicated to the James Cameron films in the Terminator franchise. He's my all-time favorite filmmaker. Terminator is my all-time favorite thing, and I created a podcast about it. Stumbled across your podcast on iTunes by typing in James Cameron podcast, and I really like what you guys are doing with yours. So I wanted to see if maybe at some point we could collaborate, you know, since we have podcasts specifically devoted to James Cameron films. I think it'd be really cool. Let me know. Get in touch with me on social media at T101 Podcast, Facebook, Instagram or Twitter and let me know.
And nobody can contact me that way anymore. It's gone. Someone else has it.
I know. I when I refound that message and I went to look it up, I was like, okay, so that doesn't exist anymore, I guess. But
it's gone.
That is awesome. So what's your favorite Terminator movie?
Like everyone loves T2 and I understand it, but the Terminator, I think that's the superior film. Mainly because it gets the ideology of something coming back from the future to kill you. I think it gets it across a lot better, the horror of it.
T1's more sci-fi, I think, too.
Yeah.
T2's my favorite. It's in my top 10 probably of all time. I like T1 too, but I honestly like Terminator 3 a lot too.
You're just spiraling over here now, Ethan.
And 4, the Christian Bale. I'm also the kind of guy who likes all of the Jurassic Park movies, so.
Okay. Brittany, because I don't even think we've talked about this necessarily, like because James Cameron is so closely associated to Titanic, but you said you have also branched out a little bit, right?
I've been trying to since joining Letterboxd, but I still have not seen Terminator 2. I'm planning on seeing it in theaters though next month because one of my local theaters is doing like showing of it. And I said, okay, if there's going to be any time for me to finally see it, I'm going to go see it. So.
You got to see it. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, so I'm making plans to do that. But yeah. But anyway, so you do like Titanic, Eddie. I do know this.
No, I don't like it. I love it. It's James Cameron's best film. My favorite film of his is The Terminator. His mm-hmm. best film, his masterpiece, is Titanic.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. You know, I love to hear that. So, unless there's anything else you maybe want to say about your personal connection to the movie or whatever, we can jump right in. Unless
all I have to say is that was very cringy. Thank you for playing that.
Oh, your voicemail. Yeah,
I feel like I've progressed beyond that. Like that was just weird hearing that. I sound like a toddler, I feel like.
Well, it is crazy though. I can't believe that was sent almost to the day though, back in 2019. That's crazy.
Yep.
But yeah, here we are, and I'm excited to get into it.
Likewise.
So, before we get into the official top of the scene, we have to talk about this deleted scene with Lovejoy and Jack and Rose. Tell me why I took a page and a half of notes just on this deleted scene, front and back.
Yeah, I think I took more notes on the deleted scene than I did on the actual scene.
Oh, God. How are you feeling about it, Eddie?
I didn't take notes, and I don't want you to think that doesn't mean I didn't take this seriously.
No, it's fine.
This movie is so ingrained in my head that I felt mm-hmm. very comfortable just being like, you know, just kind of winging it. But I a page and a half of notes on this deleted scene. I'm curious what...
And hopefully we can zoom through the rest for the actual scene, which is like another 2.5 pages. I didn't think I was going to have much to say either, but I always surprise myself. Yes. So first things first. So the scene picks up with Cal after he says that he realizes he put the diamond in the coat and he put the coat on Rose. So then he turns to Lovejoy and says, "I give it to you." Is that what he says?
Yeah, I think that's what he says, right?
I give it to you. I give it to you. If you can get it. Bastard.
Is he saying, like, I'm going to give you the necklace?
Yeah.
Then why does he want it if he's just going to give it to Lovejoy?
That's what I'm saying. I said, wait. Cal is making Lovejoy go after this diamond that Cal clearly wants for himself for some sort of incentive to get what?
We're going to go off on a 5-minute tangent on just Lovejoy achieving his personal gain of this necklace.
It's so ridiculous. So Lovejoy calls Cal a bastard under his breath. So we know that he just doesn't even really like Cal either at this point. We know. So he takes off to go find Jack and Rose, who are stuck behind another closed door in the back of the first class dining room. And I was laughing. I was sitting here watching this deleted scene, laughing at this the imagery of Lovejoy reloading his gun while he's wading through chest deep water while the Titanic is sinking. I was like, this is just absolutely... Yeah.
It's like Apocalypse Now.
It's just...
Because you mess with, like, when you messaged me, you sent me that scene and you were like, this very James Cameron-y scene. I when you watch any of the deleted scenes from Titanic, it makes you appreciate, and this kind of ties into, because James Cameron has multiple cuts of pretty much all of his movies, and he's released them. You know, like, there's a special edition of Aliens, there's a special edition of The Abyss there, and so he has this tendency to film a lot of stuff and then trim it down. And 9 times out of 10, I always prefer the theatrical edition of all of his movies. And the same goes for Titanic, because when you look at something like this, right, this deleted scene, it feels very unrealistic in a very realistic movie.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't add up. Like, why? I don't care what's going on right now. There are more dire situations at hand. Why are you, like you said, wading through water, reloading your gun, hunting down this person? It doesn't make sense, even in this situation. So it's fun to watch them. They make you laugh, particularly the ending, like the Bill Paxton deleted scene is so funny.
It's already come up in conversation quite a bit, but yeah.
But that's all they really are. It's just, oh, Cameron, this is one reason why you're the best. Film whatever you want. But make sure you cut it if it isn't up to par with the rest of your film.
Yeah, especially since it doesn't even resolve anything. It's obviously, I mean, if I just mentioned the ending, nothing happens. Like, they just go their separate ways again. And it's like, then why did we just waste 5 minutes? As an isolated scene, it's insanely drawn out.
Yes.
And then on top of it, it embellishes Lovejoy's character too much and kind of like steers him too much in the direction of like the main antagonist, like the definitive villain, versus just like the henchman.
It muddies things up too much.
It's definitely too hyper focused on Lovejoy, and I think he's better as the heel, maybe. Or
it's extremely drawn out, and it's just so crazy to think that this would happen at such a point in the film where, you know, things were just ramping up, you know what I mean? And we got this intense scene with Jack and Rose that we just came off of, that gun chase. And then suddenly now we just completely crawl at a snail's pace for no reason right now.
Well, then the next scene is so tension filled, and it's like, why do we need to break that up? Let's just parlay it into this next thing.
Exactly, which is obviously what the theatrical cut ended up being, which says a lot about how not necessary this deleted scene really was, because you cut it out and you'd never even know it was here. And I think that's a true testament to know, yeah, we didn't need that.
The music was cool, though. I liked the lower register piano. I couldn't remember if that appeared anywhere else in the movie. It was kind of cool. But that's literally not worth keeping in just for that.
I think it's mainly just, it is nice for the audience, right? And you're pulling out, maybe it is in there. Maybe it's in there. I have that, and for some reason, I haven't read it cover to cover. I just have it to have it kind of thing. But like, I think it's so that you get some form of a... You know, for what Lovejoy does to Jack with the, you know, punching him in the stomach, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of that, like, okay, cool, this is the payoff for the audience.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
It clearly is, because he says the compliments of the Chippewa Falls, Dawson's line, which I've mentioned many times in the past, but here we are, this is finally it.
Yep.
This is the scene where that happens.
I think that's all it is, ultimately. Let's give Jack that, you know...
And also, when Jack appears and he becomes all action hero, and he, you know, smashes Lovejoy's head into the glass, and then he smashes Lovejoy's head into the wall, that was also supposed to give us context for when we see Lovejoy during the sinking. We see him again one more time, and his head is all bashed in. And we're just left to think that, oh, he obviously got into, like, some sort of trouble in the sinking, because he ends up being like right where the ship splits in half. We just figured like, oh, he just, you know, got injured somehow. But this is why he looks that way. But yeah, Cameron, what he had to say about this is, quote, Audiences hated this scene. Even when I was writing it, I knew it was a bit of a forced excursion, but I thought audiences would want to see Jack being heroic and winning out against Lovejoy. Of course, after it was shot, the scene had its own reasons for staying in. It was visually impressive, it was expensive to shoot, but these reasons have nothing to do with dramatic validity. We were holding on to something that the audience wasn't buying, and we simply couldn't see it. So then I thought, all right, maybe it's just too long. So I cut the scene in half, and we screened the film again. No change. The audience still hated it. Reading the second test audience's comments, I realized that by introducing guns and fistfights, I had committed a tonal violation. Audiences didn't want the additional jeopardy because they were so completely focused on the dangers of the sinking. The scene had to come out.
I like to just imagine an entire crowd of people just booing.
No.
We hate this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then he goes on to say, for the next screening, I removed the fight scene entirely and I was convinced it wouldn't fly. Jack and Rose just sort of run in and run out. And the next time you see them on the stairs, you have no clue as to why. But the audience went nuts. They loved the movie. We got no negative responses at all. A brief reshoot enabled Cameron to smooth out the continuity. Also, Lovejoy was digitally removed from one of the shots of the flooding first-class dining room so that audiences could still experience the visceral thrill of what Cameron called elegance submerged. And then Cameron goes on to say, the whole process was so revealing of how an audience thinks. If you can get them to play by your rules, and it takes time and effort to do that, then you'd better not break your own rules. The audience won't stand for it. They'll become the concept police. But yeah, pretty much kind of what you said, though, there, Eddie, at the top of that, his reasoning for doing it was that, you know, let's show Jack be a hero and against Lovejoy and whatever. But
and I also think to add on top of that, you know, this is based on a true story and there's already a lot of liberties in terms of this fictional romance, right? Now you have to ask audiences that are watching it to not only buy into that, but now buy into something that, you know, did not happen. You know, yeah. There's nobody running around on the real Titanic trying to shoot somebody.
Yeah. That's
I highly doubt anybody was genuinely actually, and no disrespect to like I'm not trying to disrespect any, but if anything, I was watching Titanic Honor and Glory, an interview on Titanic Talk with Alexandra Boyd, and the creator of that, or the guy who heads that Titanic Honor and Glory, he said something that a lot of people probably don't realize is that most of the sinking of the Titanic was probably pretty calm. Once you got past the initial hit, from that point on, it took some time, and you know, there probably wasn't a whole lot actually genuinely going on in terms of freaking out and trampling over people. And he even said that Cameron probably, you know, took some liberties there, expedited it, made it more dramatic.
Naturally.
Yeah. So
just a couple little other bullet points that I had written for this deleted scene before we move on. I said that all of the carts rolling around were just kind of making me laugh after a certain point, because I was like, we get it, the ship's on an incline, the carts are rolling, and like one of them bumps into Lovejoy and stops him in his tracks, and I'm like, okay. There's also like no dialogue for almost 2 minutes straight.
Yeah.
Which is insane.
But there's also not even really anything else happening either. It's just them kind of crawling around, you know.
So I thought it was also funny how he goes up to Rose and says, I've been looking for you, miss, and like holds the gun right at her. I'm like, firstly, he already said that line earlier in the movie. He said, we've been looking for you, miss, when they came back right before they're gonna frame Jack with the necklace. He says, we've been looking for you, miss. And I'm like, okay, why would you repeat the same line again, unless this was also supposed to be like a, remember he said that before and now he's gonna take her out. Because I was thinking about that too. I'm like, was he really just about to just shoot Rose point blank in the head for this diamond and then go back to Cal and be like, hey, I got the diamond, but you know, I murdered Rose.
Yeah, that's the other thing. You know, like what you were saying, Eddie, like, you know, neither Rose, especially not Rose, nor Jack are going to die in this moment.
Exactly. Once again. Yeah.
Like the audience wants to see how they come face to face with like the Titanic actually to the end of the Titanic's lifespan. So you know that they're not going to die right here. So another thing that kind of removes you from that tension. When they're trapped underneath the water, that's legitimately like, how are they going to get out of this? Like, that's very much tension filled.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so basically that deleted scene ends with, we get another Jack Dawson door body slam, which I had mentioned before. This would have been one too many, or like too many, basically, because we got that one earlier in the third class hall where he slams a door down. He broke a gate down with a bench, and now he would have knocked another door down with his body. So, and I love the way Lovejoy kind of shoots after them one last time, very dramatically, like in slow motion. Boom! Because he was like trampled to the ground by Jack and everything. So he's getting up to get one last shot in before Jack and Rose run away. I also love how Jack is all very like disoriented after knocking the door down. He's like, whoa.
Yeah. It's so like when you watch any deleted scene from a movie that you've watched so many times, right? And then you watch this thing, it's so not ingrained in your head. You can't help but feel amused by it.
Yeah.
I've never watched a deleted scene from Titanic that I didn't have some sort of an amusement to.
Yeah.
It's just sort of like, this shouldn't be here. Like, I can't imagine it actually being in the movie, you know?
Yep.
Seeing Leo kind of fumble around, that's not part of his MO, you know? Like Brittany says, he takes on Action Man when the ship hits the thing, you know? All of a sudden, to make him woozy and stuff, you know, it's bizarre to watch.
Yeah, but I just wrote, like, the tumbling around on the tables, the trying to grab the gun, the shots going off. I'm like, what is going on?
Yep.
But yeah, so Jack and Rose run away. They end up running down into a stairwell instead of up. And in the screenplay, it says that, you know, Lovejoy, when he goes to run after them, which obviously is cut out of the film, but he heads upstairs. And it said, because who wouldn't run upstairs? Obviously, that's where he must have thought they went. But I guess Jack was smart and thought, no, because they almost go up and then they go down. Because he probably thought, yeah, if we go up, he'll find us. So let's go down. But obviously, that doesn't matter because it was cut anyway. But where the scene starts properly, we see them run down the stairwell and they stop and they pause to wait and listen. And so in the theatrical cut, we're supposed to think that, you know, they're running away from Cal still. They've run now, they've hidden over here, and they're stopping to wait and see if Cal's still coming after them is kind of what it's supposed to be. And then at the same time, also, they're stopping to hear that they notice a child screaming. So it's kind of like a double thing that works there. So they stop and they go and they see this poor boy standing there, left on his own. The way the scene was set, like, so just to suddenly have a kid just standing there, yeah, and just like screaming.
Like it's kind of abrupt. It just randomly a kid there. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just the poor kid's just standing there. And it's like, why would the father leave this child? And why is the poor child just standing there? I mean, apparently this kind of stuff happened on the historical commentary. They said that they heard some testimony of people noticing children just left alone during the sinking and stuff. So
is the child ever seen earlier in the film that like, see this stuff? I don't know, like, because I've always truly wondered why she says we can't leave him. And, you know, like, I understand, be a good person, right? Save somebody. But it would be nice if there was some little moment, like, you know, how she looks across and sees the little girl, you know, being taught by her mom.
Yeah.
Something like that, you know, where it's sort of like, I remember you from the other day and we shared a little tiny moment.
Right. I'm trying to think if maybe he might have been around in one of the deleted scenes, like at the third class or something. I don't know. I think it's more so just the idea that it's a child and they can't, you know, they can't turn their back on a child in good conscience. You know what I mean? They can't just turn around and leave this poor kid. I had written that I always really liked that line. If they were to really keep hold of this kid, you know, now they have a third life they have to worry about. I said I love Leo in this scene so much. Because there's something about like him being a little bit fatherly to this child and like being trying to be protective of him and like holding him close to him and like holding his head, and the intensity of, you know, running to one end of the hallway and it being flooded and like having to stop and say like, no, go back. Like, just something about this with the score is, I return to this scene quite a bit. I don't know what it really is about it, but even that, there's that one shot where they are running and Jack stops and it's like a close-up on him. They use that in the trailers. So, I mean, it must have stood out to the trailer editors and stuff too as something cool. I don't know, but it always stood out to me and it's one of my favorite parts.
Well, and two, we never see, obviously, like, Jack and Rose never get the chance to have their own kids. So, like, to have a moment like this is kind of cool.
Exactly.
However brief it is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that's definitely another reason why I like it. I said before, like, with the deleted scene of, like, Jack and Cora together.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, she calls him Uncle Jack or whatever. I'm like, it's just so sweet because, you know, they don't get that chance. You know, he never is going to get that chance. So it's just any little glimpses you can get of those sorts of moments, I think, are nice. And yeah, I just think it's a good action moment, I guess. There's just something about it, the pumping of the score in the background, the, you know, the threatening water flooding and just everything about it. I really have always been drawn to it,
even more so than the like the gun chase, the first gun chase. This is the most all-around action-y, I think, sequence that so far. So that's kind of interesting. And a lot of this reminded me of Way of Water.
Once again.
I mean, the whole time I was watching the new Avatar, I was like, man, there's so much Titanic in here. Mm-hmm. And this is maybe the most like reminiscent of that.
Yeah, this whole sequence into the end of the scene. Yeah.
Just where they're kind of like, you know, their heads are like, it's all, the water level's almost at the top. It's really interesting how much I think he consciously pulled from this. Oh, maybe.
Totally to me. But
I'm guessing you've seen Way of Water, Eddie.
Yes. Yeah.
Did you like it, or how would you think about it?
I liked it. I love Avatar, the first one.
Yeah, me too.
I think it should be a standalone movie. I know he's also talking about making another movie outside of the Avatar movies, like the bombing of the Hiroshima. Yeah. That's what I want him to do. You know, I want him to like get away from Avatar.
You want a new new story by James Cameron. Yeah,
yeah, totally. You know, if he were to do something that is so outside of the norm now, and his norm now is Avatar, people look back and go, remember that movie about the Hiroshima bombing that he did? Like, where did that come from?
Yeah, it was like when Coppola did The Conversation in between the two Godfather movies. And it's like, whoa, he had this like amazing movie between the two Godfather movies that nobody seems to ever talk about because they always talk about The Godfather.
Yeah. And if he's so adamant about doing Avatar, I hope he does what he says, where he'll direct 1, 2, and 3, and then he'll kind of step away and let other people pick up the rest of the movies. I kind of hope he just does the trilogy.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
But going back to this scene, because... why did I want to do this scene in particular?
Yeah.
Right, because that's right around here, right? So the angry father appears, which James Cameron said is a Polish stuntman. And I think he calls Jack an idiot, right? Idiota or something like that, he says. That's what I've always heard. But there's a lot of miscommunication going on. Obviously, Jack was trying to save his child, but he's like, give me my child. It always killed me when this poor man goes to lift up his suitcase as well. I'm like, it's just such a little detail, but I'm like, that's not important right now. Like, he literally picks up the suitcase, ready to leave the ship. Like, I'm just like, no. And of course, Jack and Rose are yelling at him, telling him it's the wrong way, come back. And the door bursts open. Yeah, this is pretty much what you had said, Eddie. You wanted to be on at the scene with the giant wave, so.
This moment right here.
I know, Cameron made sure to say that the little boy was replaced with a foam dummy so that no children were harmed in the making of this scene.
Oh, yeah. But what's funny is if I was in charge of doing the scenes, because your podcast is centered around basically like the DVD scene index, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, but we've been dividing them up to however it suits us.
As it's taken us longer to conquer each scene, we've started dividing them up, I think.
Or just like to make room for certain guests as well, like you. Like, this was like a perfect time to start it.
Okay. So in the DVD or Blu-ray or whatever, is the official scene, like, is this officially where it starts?
It starts with them in the stairwell overhearing the kid screaming. That's where it starts. Like, with all of like the flooding tables and stuff, and then them.
Yeah. Interesting. See, if I was in charge of that, all I would do is I would take it back to her going down on the lifeboat. Because for me, that's like this, from there to them reuniting to Cal shooting at them, going down to the tidal wave, and then to the gate where they get, you know, pushed up against the gate and they're like asking for help from the guy. That to me is the scene. That's the scene. Sometimes they'll chop it up even more from that. But for me, that's the whole summation. And that's everything I love about Titanic in a nutshell. I cry when Rose jumps back on the boat and they run to each other. That's where I cry. To me, that's the more emotional part of the story. It's you could have escaped, but you're jumping back on. And it culminates here in, I think, arguably, if not one of, but definitely my favorite action scene in any film anywhere of all time. It's this scene right here. This scene right here. I have always, I remember being a kid, and this was the moment I would always just rewind. The door bursting open, because when you're a kid, that's just fun looking. Like, that's just like, that reminds you of like a water park. He gets swept away, the Polish stuntman. So it's like, oh, cool. But when you're a kid, you don't register that that's freezing water. That's that's so much. But it's just, to go back to the Avatar thing, if that was in Avatar: The Way of Water, something like that, like, I wouldn't have reacted to it as strongly as I do this, because this is practical.
Totally, yeah.
The only CGI in the scene is the to cover up their faces. That's it. This is real people in a practical set running from a giant wave. I can't imagine how fun that was to film.
Yeah, that's old school right there. That's super cool. Yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah.
And James Horner's score...
Yes, I put a note that the score is the same as the iceberg collision scene.
Okay.
Right before the iceberg collision. So it's right when they go iceberg right ahead, that score is the same thing here. The dun, 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 that whole like thing is happening right here again. So that's interesting. But wow, that's crazy that this is like your favorite action scene, period.
Period. I don't even care about the CGI stuff. You know, when I found out, because for the longest time, I thought that was Leo and Kate running. Like, it doesn't seem like it's that dangerous. You know what I mean? It seems like you can do it. But then when I found out it's the face replacement, I'm like, it is what it is. You got the lights flickering. It hides it nice.
See, it's funny because for me and my mom, we always could tell something was wrong.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out what was going on. So I didn't know if it was just me or what was happening. But yeah, I didn't know there was that going on.
The face shape, like Leo's doesn't look that bad, but Kate, and she's in the front, obviously, and you're paying more attention to her. And her stunt double, I think, had a longer, more pointed face shape than Kate. And so they're trying to like stretch Kate's face to fit on top of this face shape that doesn't really match.
Her head looked flat. Like her forehead looked like it was cut off or something.
Yep. Her head looks very flat. Yep.
You know, I'm surprised because Cameron is kind of notorious after re-releasing T2 in theaters in 2017. He's kind of notorious for going back in. So in Terminator 2, he replaced stunt doubles that you could tell were not Arnold Schwarzenegger. He put Arnold's face on them. When it came back this year, Titanic, I do remember going in and going, I wonder if Cameron tweaked, you know, to make it look better. But he didn't. I guess he didn't.
No, but you know what? I kind of appreciate that. I feel like this is, you know, I mean, even he has called Titanic his baby a couple of times. And so I feel like I kind of appreciate that he wouldn't do that for this movie, that it's like, this is how we made it when we made it. You know what I mean? There's something special and intangible about that. We'll go in and restore the quality in general to, like, you know, clean it up, make it look, you know, as pristine as we can keep it as the years go on, as technology advances. But little things like that, it's like, keep it in there, you know, why not?
So you're not a fan of Greedo shooting first?
I'm assuming that's a Star Wars reference?
Yeah.
Yes.
Let me blow your minds here. I've only seen 4 and 5.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Wow. I'm not a Star Wars guy. I can't get into it.
Well, then this is the wrong podcast for you to be on.
No, yeah, I'm a big Star Wars guy. I mention it probably every episode for some reason, but yeah.
Yep. And Brittany, you're not like a Star Wars person.
Oh no, I am. I got my episode 3 poster over there in the corner. But
she likes 1, 2, and 3.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm a 4, 5, 6 guy.
I was expecting to see a hairspray poster right there when you turned it.
Oh, I got one over here.
Okay, good. Let's turn this into a Hairspray podcast.
I got one over there.
There we go. Ethan, have you seen Hairspray?
Oh, yeah. I saw it in theaters. Was that 07 or something?
07,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw it in theaters back then. I think that's the only time I've seen it. But Brittany and I both love School of Rock, though. That's one of our, that's one of her favorites. And I love School of Rock. I saw that, I think, 3 times in theaters.
You kind of give me, like, you're like, not exactly, but you give me a vibe of Jack Black.
Me or Brittany?
Ethan!
That was good.
No, I love Jack Black.
Teed that up for you. That was good. That was good.
Yeah, so... you were saying, Ethan, that Rose's head looks flat. Yeah, no, totally flat, I always thought the same thing.
But yeah, like, you don't need to fix that. I mean, as obvious as it is, and as, I mean, it's not good CGI to today's standards, but it's like this, it's charm that doesn't affect the quality of the movie. It doesn't take away anything, you know? Mm-hmm. So when, like, everyone always fixes, like George Lucas and you said James Cameron did with T2, like, you don't need to do that. That's just like an obsession, I think.
Because I do almost feel like if he did fix it, I would kind of feel some type of way about it. I would be like, ugh. Because, you know what I mean? I'm so used to seeing it the way it is that if he changed it, even if he made it look better, I still might kind of miss the way it looked.
Yep. That was me when T2 came out. I was like, no, why would you do that? I was so used to seeing someone clearly not Arnold.
Yeah, I've never heard a good argument for going back and changing things that are like from 30-year-old movies.
Yeah, I don't get it. But thankfully, he didn't do it on this one, and... hopefully that's, it stays when, because supposedly this year we're getting a 4K of it.
Yeah, home release, yeah, I think.
There's not a 4K? Oh, wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, they only just, it's just standard Blu-ray right now. Yeah.
Yep.
That's cool.
But I still do think it's interesting, though, that if they knew that they were going to have to replace the faces on these stunt doubles, why would they make it such a central moment? Why would they have it be these two people filmed dead on running down the hallway in slow motion?
The slow motion is what makes it obvious. Yeah,
I think that's exactly. I think that might have been a later decision, you know, to when you see the footage put together, maybe them running just down the hall normal paced, it didn't have that same feel.
Maybe if it was in regular time, like, you know, regular motion, maybe the stunt doubles looked obvious anyway, but they couldn't get the CGI face replacements as cleanly, and so they had to do it. But if they didn't do it at all, it would have been obvious that it was a stunt double, so they had to do it in slow motion maybe to get the faces to show up. That's the only thing I can think of, other than an aesthetic choice, which it could have been.
And then we're, you know, just like anything in 1997, probably nobody picked up on that, you know?
I mean, I feel like my mom and I always caught it, but
really?
But yeah.
People weren't thinking of CGI in that way, I don't think.
We weren't thinking of CGI, we just knew that something looked off.
Yeah, sure. But yeah, exactly. But I think, your brain, if you don't know it's, for most people, if you don't know it's an option that they could do something with CGI, you're just like, oh, that looks weird, but like, whatever, it's just me or something like. Yeah, that's what I thought when I watched it this time, actually.
Ultimately, I do wonder if there was any discussion, Leo and Kate, do it.
Oh, for them to go ahead and do it.
Or if from paper to film, it was Leo and Kate, do not do this.
There's nothing. I think it was always intended to be, because like Cameron didn't mention anything like that on the commentary, I don't think, or if he did, I just glossed over it. Let's see. Well, yeah, they said that he did mention like the digital face replacements and the stunt doubles. Never mentioned if Leo and Kate would have done it, but he did say that the force of the water was really crazy and something everybody really underestimated. They didn't realize how strong and forceful this water was going to be, and then that because of all of these, the intensity of these water scenes had been ramping up, it started to genuinely get scary for everyone involved.
I think a lot of times actors aren't allowed to do certain things like that.
Anything could happen, and then you're out your main actor.
Yeah, unless you're like maybe Tom Cruise and that's your thing, And then he can say, no, I want to do that, or don't.
Literally
do that.
Jumping from like a bazillion feet high off of.
I think it's union. I think it's a union thing. If you're a like a lead or something in a movie, and I could be wrong. I think like unless your contract states otherwise, if you're in the Screen Actors, you can't do something like that unless you have like a stunt clearance.
Okay.
Or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's like something weird with stunts.
So. I said that Jack and Rose get swept away by this wave, but not without saying each other's names again. So they're swept away. And as they're going down this hallway at like 20 miles an hour, you hear, Jack, Rose!
Yep.
You can actually tell if you pause that, you can see that those are clearly their stunt doubles.
Yes.
It's kind of funny. The Jack guy does not look like Leo when you pause it, but he goes by so fast you don't notice in the moment.
Well, that's what I thought with Alexandra's episode with one of Leo's stand-ins. I was like, wow, you really don't look like Leo at all. not a smidgen. And then I saw a photo of him on the set and I was like, wow, I guess just from the back, you might look like him, but... Don't look like him, that's for sure.
I guess from the back, you might
look like him if they CGI the back.
I met a guy in Hollywood one time, and he said that he gets paid by Johnny Depp to stand in for Johnny Depp at like certain events, and people think it's Johnny Depp. And he looks, I was like, there's no way this guy's not Johnny Depp. And I asked him, and he was like, I was just started talking to this guy, and he was telling me this story.
Wow.
Yeah.
So as they're flying down this hallway super fast with the rush of water, they hit another closed gate and they hit it with a lot of force. And as a kid, literally, I want to say until maybe last year, I did not realize that they didn't get the gate open and made it through the gate. I just realized like last year that they turned around and they went back towards the stairwell that they went flying by.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why. Like for some reason, the way it was cut my whole life, I just thought that the gate was a little bit open or something. And they were able to, you know, shimmy their way through this open gate to get to this next place. I don't know.
I guarantee you it's the fact that this is the moment where even I, because I'm not prone to any of this stuff, but I even have to kind of close my eyes.
Yes.
Those flickering lights.
Yep. Yeah. I was thinking the same thing. Yeah. I'm a little photosensitive, and I had it like within my left eye only from a concussion I had years ago. So I have to like close my eyes during stuff like this. And this one got me for sure.
Yeah.
I wrote that in my notes. I said the flickering lights are definitely tough here. I can only imagine how it must be for some people.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Cameron had mentioned something as well about the lights. He had said, I should have wrote it down. Maybe I'll put in a clip.
So we use the idea that the salt water would be shorting out the electrical system to justify this shameless use of strobe lights. But really what it is it creates a kind of an externalization of what it would feel like to be in that situation where things are just coming at you as impressions, as these kind of stroboscopic impressions.
But it was interesting the way he worded it. I was like, huh, I didn't think about it that way. Like photo shocks of like all these different things coming at you.
Or
like
it's a very alien moment too, I think.
I think it's it ramps everything up, you know. It makes the stakes higher all of a sudden. Now the whole corridor is flooding, so you have that, you have the rush of everything, and you can't even see, so it just adds like this next level of like, oh my god. I think it's the most intense moment in the entire film. And I know that the ship breaks and that's intense and all that stuff. But to me, this is just because these are the characters we care the most about.
And it's just the two of them in it together in this scene. Yeah.
That's what's scary about it. Yeah. Especially when they climb back up and the guy's like trying to help them and he fumbles and it's like, oh God.
But yeah, so they are turning around in this scene. Essentially, Jack's saying, okay, no, let's go this way. Like, let's try to pull against the current now to get up to this stairwell that we went flying past. And they do. They make it. They start walking up. And then they, you know, the camera pulls all the way back and we see that they're behind yet another locked gate.
I love that.
Yeah. It's a great shot.
It's a phenomenal shot. Yeah, absolutely. And Russell Carpenter is the DP on this. And so I don't know whose idea it was. Maybe it's in the book, but whoever's idea it was to put the camera through and then, just kidding. Genius stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's super good.
Yep. And you really feel the anguish, right? Because you're like, are you serious? Here's another. I mean, I do think the historians, I mean, they had said something about it being, there was even another one that, like another scene of them being behind another locked gate. And they were like, yeah, just one too many locked gates. But with this one, yeah, after having gone through everything they've gone through, and then you think, oh, you should be getting, you know, they found the stairwell, they're going to get out. And then, nope, just kidding. Once again, here's another roadblock. And I love the way Rose just says, oh God, you know what I mean? Because it's like, yeah, literally, oh God, yeah. No, here we go again. So I did say, just as they get there, they're shaking it a little bit, and then this steward comes running by. And I said, a little too convenient.
Yeah, yeah. For sure.
Yeah. You know?
Just a little bit convenient. Yeah. You might have been able to write something else in there where, I don't know. Like, I don't know how you would get the keys to them.
I guess the only reason that stood out to me now was because this isn't the first time that a steward just, like, happened to be there. Rose just, that, remember when she gets in the hallway when the lights go out? And then the lights come back on, and then a steward is right there coming around the corner telling her, like, oh, miss, you shouldn't be here. And that's the one that she punches. Okay, so now there's another moment where she's in, like, immediate danger, and a steward just comes running right by the thing in a very, like, heavily flooding area of the ship.
Yeah, like, at this point, why is... Yeah, he'd already be up top, yeah.
Yeah, odds are someone wouldn't be around, you know, probably, so...
To me, it would have been funny if it was the same guy she punched. And then he realizes who it is, right? So he takes out his keys because it's a flurry, and then he, like, you know, and he looks up and he's like, oh, it's you. And then he, like, throws them, like, fend for yourself or something like that.
Well, that would have, wow, yeah. That would have been a choice. But yeah, so this steward is almost about to keep going, but they're left there and they're saying, please help us, please. And he takes one more step. He's about to leave them. But then he says, bloody hell, and decides to try to start helping them. And, like, right then they allow the sound of the rushing water to really pick up right after he makes the decision to help them. And interesting, the historians said that since Jack and Rose were speaking English, they wonder, you know, is that why the steward stopped? Like, if they had not been speaking English, if there had been a language barrier, would that man have bothered to try to help them or whatever? That was just something that they thought about out loud, I guess, which... It's kind of interesting.
Because I can see something like this happening in the real story, you know? Like, I can actually see something like this happening where people are stuck behind gates and they can't get out and they're, you know, begging and pleading for their lives and somebody just happenstance comes along. And so this isn't unbelievable to me. It is convenient, but it is believable enough. So that's why it's never struck me as like, ugh. Come on.
Oh, yeah. No, of course. Yeah, no. Never did to me either until I've started, like, looking at things a little bit. Because, I mean, honestly, I've seen Titanic how many times? You know what I mean? So at this point, I'm like, I'm going to start noticing things that I, you know, might not have thought of or cared to think of before. And I also realized the other day, too, I feel like I'm severely lowballing the amount of times I've watched this movie. Every time I tell my mom, you know, when I say... You know, I go, what do I usually say? Like, at least 100. I'm like, oh, that is a severe lowball, I think. Because I think back to all the times I was a kid alone. Just as a kid in the late 90s into the 2000s watching my VHS on repeat. That alone is 100 times in, like, probably 1998 alone. You know what I mean?
I think the most I've seen any movie is maybe, like, 40 times.
Yeah.
Maybe like 25. Toy Story would probably be the movie I'd seen the most.
Because I was thinking as well, like, even just with the theatrical releases, I've already seen it like I don't know, like 13 or 14 times in theaters.
Jeez.
Considering that, and then all the times I've definitely watched it as a kid, and then all the times I've definitely watched it over all these years of my life since I was 5 years old, that's a severe lowball to say 100. There's no way.
Eddie, how many times have you seen Terminator?
Definitely not 100. Like you said, probably like 20, 30 times. I've turned people on to it for sure. And I tend to usually, you know, watch it with them, you know, because I love doing that thing where you just kind of look over at somebody and you're waiting for their reaction. And 9 times out of 10, they don't have one. What are you not getting about this? Like I know I've looked at people during this scene where I'm like, this is good, isn't it? This is good. This is good stuff right here, isn't it? Yeah, they're into it, but it's like they're not having that visceral reaction where it's like, you know, I think when I saw it in the theater this time, I'm pretty sure I was doing something like this.
Gripping the seat, yeah.
I'm gripping the seat or like I'm squeezing something, like, you know.
Yeah, I don't get how people watch movies passively, just like a good movie, like an entertaining movie. I can't even fathom, you know, like a comedy. I've watched comedies with people and they're like not laughing. And I'm like, you didn't think I was funny? They're like, no, it was funny. Like way within like... You laugh, it's like not funny enough.
Then
to
laugh.
Or like, yeah, I don't get it.
I feel like one of you guys just said something that made me think of something and now I forgot. Oh, I do remember one time when I was showing Titanic to the high schoolers I taught at one point. They were very into the scene. I do remember that. They were, for whatever reason, I remember looking and they were all just like kind of glued to the projector that we were watching it on, and they were really into it, so I can see that.
Yeah,
it's intense. Yeah.
I do know I have to mention, and we haven't gotten to it yet, but something that I'll call her Rose. Like I always like calling characters by their actors' names. It's weird, but I'll call her Rose. That something Rose says that's always stuck out to me. It's like, man, that was such a weird thing you did there. Do you know what I'm like? Do you know what I'm hinting at? It's right in this moment, right here.
Is it like her cadence or like the way she says it? Is it when she says, please send for help or whatever?
Yep. Please send for help.
Yep.
And you know, now that you say this, because I've never thought of this, but you know, maybe it's, but it's weird because the guy speaks English too and very good English. So it's not like she's trying to like send for help. Maybe she's just, you know, because again, I know I forget that this water is freezing.
Yeah.
So she's probably shivering, like, send for help.
Her brain is already probably like some of the stuff is disconnected.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah. You know, maybe like that was part of her character study is like maybe her brain is not, you know, computing at 100% here. So she's going to be glitching. It's just always stuck out to me, though. Send for help.
No. That always stood out to me as well. I mean, so much so I knew what you were referring to.
You picked it up. Did you pick it up, Ethan?
No, I did. I did not. No. Maybe I was writing something down at that point, but.
So the guy, the steward, is trying to help unlock the gate. And I wrote in my notes that, you know, they keep telling him, hurry, please, come on, hurry. I'm like, okay. Like, he's going as fast as he can. I'm like, I understand being stressed, but I don't think it's helping.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the steward gets overwhelmed. He fumbles the keys. He says, I'm sorry, I've dropped the keys, and goes away. And in my notes, I wrote, quote, I'm sorry, I've dropped the keys. And then I said, then duck down and get them.
Yeah, right.
You know, but anyway, at least we get this moment from Jack, which was also written in the screenplay. Originally, it was supposed to be that the steward opens the gate and they just leave with the steward. So it was originally they make it all the way up to the top where they can't breathe. And then it says, suddenly the gate gives and swings open. They are pushed through by the force of the water. They make it to the stairs on the other side of the landing and follow the steward up to the next deck. That was supposed to be what was going to happen. But then there's a note that says, as staged, the steward drops the keys and runs off, leaving Jack to retrieve them from underwater and open the gate at the last moment. Cameron wanted to give the heroic beat to Jack, but at the same time, ramping up the tension.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. But yeah, and I always did like this, though, like Jack being a go-getter, you know, he's not going to let this slide. He's like, okay, I'm going to do it myself. I'm going to go under. I'm going to find these keys. I'm going to try to figure it out. Now, this sequence here kind of was reminding me of the axe sequence of, again, with maybe being too good to be true on the first try. We're in a very intense moment, and Jack asks Rose, which one is it, Rose? I'm like she knows. You know what I mean?
It's the silver one.
And he's like, okay, so it's just the first key Rose decides. Let's just try it. And he tries multiple times, puts it all the way under the handle the first time. And it like, oh, that gets me every time when he is nowhere even near the lock.
So stressful. I was like bouncing my leg this whole time.
Yes.
Like, come on.
Or every time I watch this scene, I think about how difficult it is for me to like plug in my phone charger without looking.
Yeah.
Never mind the pressure of flowing water and life or death. Right now, if I were to like lean over and try to like plug in my phone without looking, it would take me like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
And I'd be contorting my arm all sorts of ways. And I, to the point where I just have to look.
Or use a second hand to like feel it and then guide it. Yeah.
Even when you use a second hand, it's difficult to put in a phone charger or something without looking. So then sometimes I do think to myself, you know, why didn't Jack just go underwater to do it?
Maybe he didn't want to waste it. I don't know. Waste his breath.
Yeah, because he goes down and gets the key, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Maybe the visibility is not great inside the ship or something. I don't know.
But again, I think it always goes back to, and it's a shame, like, you know, maybe sometime in the future, they'll figure out a way to do this, make it 5D. But like,
oh God,
we really can't underestimate how cold this water is.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe being under there is like affecting getting that cold water in your ears is probably not good.
And your eyes, I'm sure. Yeah. How much must that hurt your eyeballs to be open in frigid cold water?
Yeah, so you know, I'll go down and get the keys, but when now I'm coming back up and I want out of this water ASAP.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
I mean, these are literally just things I randomly think about when I take notes, by the way. Like, this isn't me trying to poke holes in the movie and be like, this was dumb, Jack should have used his eyes.
No, it's great. No, but I do think the only unforgivable moment of this whole movie is the axe. Just because I want to just quickly comment on that, because you've gone beyond that at this point. Mm-hmm. But that is the only time where I go, man, there's so many other ways you could have done that. You know, it's just, or John Wick him. I don't know if anyone gets the reference, but cut off one of his fingers or something, you know, and digitally remove his finger the rest of the movie. I don't know.
Break his hand and then slip it out, if that would work, maybe.
It's the fact she looks away. Why wouldn't you have filmed that just with her looking at it, you know? It's like, why'd you film it, her doing this kind of thing?
Yeah.
I always roll my eyes at that point. I'm just like, all right. Thankfully, it's over, and I love his reaction, and then he gets in the water, and I love that reaction. So it kind of makes up for it.
Yeah.
And at least we didn't get that deleted line, though. Remember that one, Ethan?
Oh, yeah. What did he say at that point?
Good work there, Paul Bunyan.
That's right. Good work there, Paul Bunyan.
Good Lord.
Yeah. Insane. Insane. So let's see. Oh, yes. But I did say in my notes that this is very effective as far as building the anxiety, as well as showing the speed of the sinking. Because this is another scene where it was all the way down at the bottom of the stairs when they first got to the gate. Then we saw it come up to their ankles and gave them like a little bit, they got startled by it hitting their ankles. And then the steward walks by and then it's rushing through like by their knees. And then, you know, by the time they're doing this, you know, it's only been not even a minute or so really has gone by, and it's already, we're up to their necks and they are almost drowning. So it really shows you how fast this particular section of the ship is sinking. But again, it does feel like kind of what we were saying about like with the gun chase and everything, that they're still probably not going to die here.
Because,
look, I mean, we know Rose isn't. You know what I mean? It's like, we know she survives. So I said, if anything, maybe it could be Jack doesn't make it through.
Yeah, that's the only thing you can think of, right? Yeah, because you see Rose as an old lady.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, they do eventually get the gate open. And James Cameron said that Kate was actually very genuinely scared. And she was nervous about whether or not they would actually be able to stop the flooding in time. He said that, of course, the gate wasn't really locked and they had diving instructors off camera, like right on the sides to help anybody. But yeah, she was genuinely very nervous about it. You can almost sense that in her acting. I feel like it does become very genuine at a certain point when it gets, you know, like this high, like right up to her mouth, basically. And she's tilting her head all the way back. She's just screaming at that point, like genuinely screaming.
Yeah, as an actor, those are probably like the most terrifying things to see. To film those scenes where like the water is rising and you have to like tilt your head back and you have like 2 inches of breathing room.
But of course, again, they make it through right on time, right before they lose that inch of breath. As they, you know, make their way through this over this threshold, you know, it does take Jack a minute to reappear. So I think, you know, that obviously must have been the thing to hook you in that moment, is like, is Jack going to be, you know, to make it through this? Because he's not there for a minute and you worry, oh no, he got swept away.
Yeah, it wouldn't work if she was the one who came up next, because there'd be in vain.
Yeah, exactly. You do have to think though, it's like, would they really kill off Jack like that? Like, we still have, you know, have at least a half an hour to go or something. He's not just going to be swept away, never seeing him again. That was the last we saw of him. He's just gone. No, he's not going to go out that way. But yeah, he pops back up and she says, come on. And he swims under again, comes up, and they make their way up the stairs and out to some semblance of safety. Yeah, I always remembered the way they're totally soaked to the bone when they come out from this scene. Yep. And the way Jack is like drowning in his shirt. The peasant-y kind of sleeve is just hanging off of him. He looks so much younger and more fragile in this poor shirt. And yeah, that's how the scene ends.
And that's where I would end it on the DVD. You know, I would cut it right there. That's a little mini movie right there from the lifeboat kind of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
When you were talking there, I do remember, like, it brought a memory back where I don't necessarily think in this moment I ever thought this, but there have been moments in the movie where I look at the water itself and sometimes it looks like a weird color. Have we also picked up on this?
Like the greenish kind of color, the bluish greenish?
And I don't know if that's the water itself, or if that's a reflection from something that's just doing it to the water. But I do remember, you know, in my younger years watching the movie and going, this looks like it looks like pool water. It doesn't look like ocean water.
Yeah, we have been over that before. On the commentary, James Cameron, like for this scene as well, he said that this was ocean water.
They're pumping it in.
Yeah, but they said that this was in February.
But they had to heat it up, right?
I mean, I don't know. No, he said the water was freaking freezing, yeah.
And the water was freezing, too. I remember that, too. It was straight out of the ocean in February, and we were really freezing. So I remember I had the camera on my shoulder in a splash housing, and we're trying to stay still as the water's swirling all around us. You know, it was really difficult stuff to shoot, but really fun and exciting to be doing it as well. And the freezing water just kind of kept you awake better than 10 cups of coffee would. But I remember Kate and Leo were pretty glad when they made that climb up the stairwell there and got out of it for the last time.
Weird.
I'm like, so you really were going to give them hypothermia for these shots?
Yeah, that doesn't
seem
safe.
He said it was freezing cold ocean water in February. I was like, oh.
I mean, it is warmer down there, but still.
Yeah.
That's why I love Cameron is, you know, it's he has eased up over the years.
Yes.
You know, he's apparently easier to work with, but I respect. And, you know, someone like Bill Paxton, you know, never had anything bad to say about him. But let's think about what Bill Paxton did in Titanic. He was at the beginning. He's kind of through the middle and he's at the end and he doesn't touch water at all. So Cameron, I admire his early days of pushing those boundaries a little bit. You know, it can only aid the performance. Like you said, it stops being a performance and it turns into real life. And that can only make for a better overall experience and sweep the Academy Awards.
Yeah, it's very Hitchcockian, I think, too. Like Hitchcock, you see that kind of stuff.
Kubrick.
Yeah, oh yeah, dude, yes, totally.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is the end of the scene. If you have anything else you want to add, I know you just added something, but if there's you have anything else you want to add, Eddie, before we sign off here.
All I know is I am very happy that it took, you know, like I kind of lost track of it. Like at some point I was like, it's not going to happen. Like I'm not going to come on here.
Oh, no, no. I had it. I still had it in the back of my mind.
But when you came on my, on the channel and you mentioned it, I was like, you're like that. Like that was a genuine. I haven't watched it back, but I'm sure I have a visible reaction where it's like, wow, like you remember that. Like, mm-hmm. I thank both of you for having me on here. I especially thank because to my understanding, this is kind of pushing the limits for you in terms of recording time right now, Ethan. So.
Oh yeah, nah. I got kids coming home soon, but yeah.
Appreciate you squeezing me in.
Of course, man.
To talk about this because you know the day comes when we do the top movie scenes that we love. It's going to be, if not one, it'll be in the top three. So,
yeah. No, yeah, that's really cool. Yeah.
That's why I love having people come on to talk about what their favorite scene is, because that's just so, that's interesting. That's fun. You know what I mean? Like, this is your favorite scene, not only in Titanic, but ever. So why not have you come on to talk about this? You know, it's perfect.
Yeah. Why bring me on to talk about the little kid folding the napkin? You know, it's like, it's like that's a cool moment, yeah. I guess.
But thank you so much for coming on today. Really appreciate it. It was awesome to, you know, once again, have you talk about this scene. I'm glad that we were able to make it happen, even 4 or 5 years in the making, however long it's been now. You're a real OG follower of the podcast, honestly. Because, I mean, we started this in 2019, I think, right?
Yeah.
In April of 2019, we started it, and you wrote to us in June, so... From the beginning, first 3 months of this podcast's life, you had reached out to us. So it's just really awesome to have finally made this happen. Now that we're finally at this scene, because it felt like it would take us forever to even get to this moment to have you come on. So this has been a lot of fun. Appreciate it. Love hearing other people share their thoughts on the movie. Of course, if you have anything you want to plug or anything like that, feel free to say that, and we'll put all of your information in the description of the episode.
Just fans of something on YouTube. If you're listening to this, you're clearly a fan of Brittany and Ethan. And so go check out Brittany's Evening With episode. It was just kind of a deep dive into the podcast. But then, of course, like anything else, we just kind of get sidetracked and... It's a live chat going, so we took viewer questions and whatnot. And then thanks to you, I was able to talk to Alexandra Boyd as well. You made a surprise appearance on that. So there's two appearances from Brittany. I gotta get this guy on at some point.
Yeah. No, I want to go. I want to come on. I love doing other kind of crossover stuff.
Because you're a movie critic.
Yeah.
We could talk about anything. So
yeah, man.
At some point we'll have to have you on and. Kind of bring that full circle. So
yeah,
but fans of something on YouTube, that's it. If you like movies, you'll hopefully like the channel.
Yeah, don't try to search for that Terminator podcast from
Oh no. Well, actually, you know what, it's still like I have those episodes on my current podcast, so it's Eddie Green's 101. It's on Spotify, okay. Anchor, you know, all the places your podcast is. You just go all the way back, and I kept all 50 of my Terminator episodes.
Nice.
Wow.
I got to talk to Michael Biehn, you know, who played Kyle Reese. So,
because you have a ton of cool people come through your channel.
Well, you picking up that book reminded me, and I want to mention this to you because not to self-promote, but to just...
No, it's fine.
If you want to listen to it, because... I don't know of many interviews with this guy. I had Randall Frakes on my podcast.
Wow.
The guy who annotated that screenplay.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
He's a close friend of Cameron. Cool. I was able to get him on. He's a very soft-spoken guy, but it's a neat episode, yeah.
That's really cool.
Wow. And you also had Jeanette Goldstein come through and
yes.
a lot of cool people, so.
Yep. I fully expect her to be on this podcast at some point.
I mean, I don't know.
She's very cool. I can't imagine why she'd go no, you know, especially now that, you know, because you were on that same episode with her.
Yeah, I got to pop in and say hi, yeah.
So
it's crazy.
Make it happen.
That'd be cool.
that'll just about do it then. So thank you guys so much for listening. We really appreciate it. Be sure to follow us on all of the socials. Everything will be in the description of the podcast episode. All of Eddie's links and socials will be in the description as well. Be sure to send us a voicemail via the link at the very bottom of the description. Send us an email, titanicscenebyscene@gmail.com. Oh, Eddie, you're on Letterboxd, right? Are you on there frequently or...
Yes, yeah, yeah. I log everything I watch.
Okay, same. Cool, yeah. Nice. So follow all three of us on Letterboxd. All of our profiles will be linked as well. I think that'll just about do it. So we will see you in the next scene.
See ya.
Bye.